Welcome to the Rise and Scribe podcast. Our guest today is David Roth, editor of The Classical and writer at SB Nation.
All right. Well, hopefully no one else gets heard on this podcast. I'll do my best. I can't make any promises. It's still very early yet. So I guess the first thing I want to talk to you about is, I know this is kind of a generic question and kind of a tough one, but when you sit down to write, what's your process like? I mean, do you start with a sentence? Do you start, like, when something pops into your head, like, oh, okay, I can kind of flesh this out? Or is it kind of a fully formed idea and you go from that?
It depends on the piece to a certain extent. I think with a lot of what I do at SB now, like, it sort of splits in, not quite in half, but more or less. I mean, some of it is, you know, there's a video of an ostrich running in traffic or whatever. And, like, that kind of writes itself, you know. Like, those are definitely, and then, you know, the things that I do that are, like, on the news cycle are sort of, like, a, you know, for lack of a less judgy and negative-sounding term, like, a take. With that, you know, that takes longer, I guess, just because, you know, I want to try to read about what other people have written on the stuff, or if that's not available, then to sort of try to, like, mostly I don't like diagram stuff, at least for nonfiction type things. And that usually I'll sort of, like, write my way into it. And the way that I do this now, like, I'm, you know, and again, this, like, depends on how well I'm, you know, how much I'm getting out of my brain. You know, if it's nothing and it's just sort of coming out in dribbles, as it often is, then, you know, it's just sort of, you slog through and then you go back over it and try to make it less bad. But the it's that exciting and that good. But, like, with a lot of the other stuff, it's just a question of trying to get as many of the sort of things that I'm thinking or feeling down there at first, and then I go back over and edit myself a lot. I think that's where most of the good stuff comes from. And that's just an old, that goes back to just the earlier part of my writing on the internet. The first few pieces that I did, which were, you know, for freelance stuff, which, you know, like 6-7 years ago. I mean, I'd written a lot of words, you know, in my life. I've wrote a bunch of short stories that no one ever read, and, you know, not for my lack of trying, but I mean, that, you know, and so there was all that sort of stuff. But then the idea of, like, submitting something to an editor who is committing to running it and then having he or she totally take it apart and getting back some sort of just absolute Guernica of red track change bullshit. Like, that honestly, like, conditioned me to avoid that more and more. And I've gotten, like, that's the reason why I edit myself as much as I do. And, like, just, I don't want to have somebody else yelling at me. Like, if I'm going to send something in, I want it to be as close to finished and as close to the way I want it as possible. So the better part of the process is, I mean, in terms of the process is defined by work, is editing for me. Just, like, going back through and seeing if, I mean, I have these tics that I know that I have. There's, like, 5 or 6 words that I just use over and over and over again. I mean, I use a lot of words over and over again. Like, if I'm comparing, like, people to meat, or, like, the word I was talking to the former editor today about, like, queasy, daddish as a word to describe a certain type of scolding fan, D-A-D-D-I-S-H, resembling a dad. That's not even a word. Like, any of those things, like, I don't exactly, like, control F for them, but, like, I'm looking for them because, like, I know that if I'm just sort of moving under my own power, that, like, I'm going to write the same sentences over and over again. So that's most of my work is.
Is it tough for you when you find, like, those words and there's not another word to describe it?
Not another word for daddish. I guess it's a question of like, keeping your powder dry every night. Because, like, there are people that you need to compare to hams. Like, there's no other way to, like, adequately convey what they're bringing to the table. But, like, if I, and I'm lucky, too, that I don't have to write about Ben Roethlisberger every week, because, like, that's the best I've got. The guy, he looks like a, like, just an overly sexually aggressive boiled ham sticking out of a football jersey. And, like, if I had to write about him all the time and keep coming up with other ways to describe Ben Roethlisberger, I would be in a bad position. But as it is, like, you know, whatever, you do it every now and then, and then you just try to come up with other popular types of meat. Mortadella is also a pork product. It's very similar to ham. So, you know, use that sometimes. Mix it up. Keep it fresh.
What? Okay, now this leads to a really important question. Why are you sticking to ham? Because there are, you know, so many other different types of
ham. See, this is, and that's a good point. I think that, I mean, you stick to it because it's, like, kind of pink and fatty. But there's other people that resemble other types of meat, and that's always been, like, Mike Francesa, the sports radio guy, I've always compared to a veal chop. And I don't, like, which is not any, I can tell you exactly why I'm making that comparison, which is, first of all, that he kind of is just vealish. But also, there was a commercial that ran on local TV when I was a kid for a sports bar in Moonaki, New Jersey, long since closed. And the commercial was just Bill Parcells and Mike Francesa eating and pretending to argue about which food, which items they like most. And Francesa is like, oh, you got to have the veal franchise. And there's like a close-up of his mouth at the beginning of it, which is olive oil all over it. And it's like, I, basically in my mind, that is the Sarlacc from Star Wars. It's the same image. And like, so that's it. Like, this is that guy who like ate veal and turned me off veal for the rest of my life. Like, I, that guy's a veal chop. Ben Roethlisberger's a ham. What else is there? Like, John Schnatter, Papa John, I always think of as looking kind of like he's made of like a leatherette or a pleather sort of material, like you find in a booth at a restaurant. But these are like, the thing with that is that, like, you know, obviously wonderfully clever and amazing to come up with such awesome similes and all that. But like, I also tend to come up with the same ones because I'm not really very wonderfully awesome or clever. Like, once I find a thing that works and it gets stuck, then there's that. But that's like, I mean, that's the fun part about the editing stuff. And I actually had to sort of teach myself to like this because nobody likes being edited. Is that, like, you know, the process of just sort of getting it out there and like just typing as fast as you can and trying to catch up with the argument or, you know, whatever, figure out what it is you're saying or whatever. Then, like, actually removing the things that don't need to be there and winding up with something that works. Like, that's actually a better sense, a bigger sense of accomplishment, and I think like a better accomplishment in its own right than actually just being able to write the stuff fast. I do tend to write fast. I just don't, you know, the first thing I write is generally not that good.
When you're going through that, I know you talked about, you know, removing the metaphors, but is there any other thing you've taught yourself to look out for? Not necessarily words, but more thematic stuff. Like, do you find that you need to try and take yourself out of the piece more, mm-hmm. or...
For sure.
I think you've been on the lookout.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just the process of kind of, again, like, getting your ass kicked on a couple of edits, for sure, but then also, like, yeah, like, getting to the point, I usually, like, I'll give myself a paragraph or two of, depending on the piece, of, you know, like, sort of tap dance type stuff to get us, like, an overture started or whatever. But if I'm, like, 3 or 4 paragraphs deep and I'm still talking about, like, isn't it weird how you drive on the parkway and park on the driveway, whatever fuck silly thing I'm doing at the start, like, then I, you know that it's too shaggy and you have to cut. The thing that I wrote today, which I really struggled with, is about the New York Mets. And, you know, there was just so much stuff at the beginning because I was having a hard time finding my way in the piece, and like the Mets also just make me super sad, like to the point where like we're like writing about them, and it's the same thing happened when I wrote about the Brooklyn Nets last year, like things that are closer to the heart there or whatever, like I need to just sort of lay it all out and then go back through and see, you know, like how much of the I me stuff I can deal with being in there and how much of the, like, you know, the apologetics or whatever at the beginning. I mean, when I was starting out writing, especially writing fiction, that there would be like paragraphs, sometimes pages at the beginning of it. This was like in college, where it'd be like, isn't it weird that I'm writing this story and you're reading it? I know, like, that's kind of funny because, like, what are we doing reading anyway when there's all these other things? And, like, you know, that was, I think, like, true to the way that I would have, like, told a story at a party then or whatever. But, like, at some point you just have to go in. And, yeah, I mean, like, that is the sort of the thing that I've tried to get myself to do the most, just because that was, like, the first actual I mean, or at least the most enduring bad writing tendency that I had was to like just circle and circle and circle before finally getting to it. I can still do that, but those are just going to be cut and pasted and dumped in the, you know, whatever.
Right. Do you have moments where like you go back and you're just like, oh, wow, I really wrote that? Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, for sure. And even, like, not even like a million years ago either. I think that a lot of it is like, and I go back in just to see the stuff that I wrote at the, like, some of the stuff I did at the beginning of the classical. Like, I think I was just so amped to be doing it that there's, like, these marathon sentences with these marathon parenthetical clauses. And I still do that sometimes. But, like, that is a bad fucking look. And I don't know, like, where I got it. I think I just sort of started letting myself do it because I was like, this is a classical. This is my fun place to write exactly the way that I want to write. Because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't going to have some editor be like, I can't run this. This is an 85-word opening sentence to your stupid story. And, like, that is actually, like, I mean, that's the direction in which I really tend to get careless, and like going back and looking at some of the stuff I let myself get away with were like sentences that I just can't scan them myself and I wrote them. Like, that's not stuff I'm necessarily the proudest of.
Is it tough to self-edit? I mean, like, so I'm a guy who, at least when I first started out, I'm a one draft person. Like, okay, done. I'm not going to go through and like entirely change it. But as some people who can't stand just going with what they first wrote, and they have to go through it. So I don't know for you if it's tough to self-edit or if that's something you had to learn how to do along the way.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a thing that I learned to do. And, like, it's weird, too, because, like, I think that a lot of that, like, maybe I'm making extra work for myself by not slowing down and writing it and, like, sort of trying to get it right on that first draft. I mean, I am. I'm on the same timetable as everybody else. I don't always have, you know, 2 or 3 days to work all this stuff out. But, yeah, like, I think that what I've decided works, or at least what I've decided is easiest for me, is to do that and then try to sort of pull the piece out of the just big chunk of prose that I've extruded. But I think it's, you know, there's something to be said definitely for slowing down and being careful with it and trying to get that stuff ironed out in the first place. I just, the bit that I can probably work on going forward is just not micro editing my own stuff. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, want to get it right. Obviously, that's a good thing. There's just also like a tendency, I think, that, you know, that I have, and that I think you can't really afford to have it on the internet. But I mean, it's not you can't really afford to have it at all, where this wish to not let go of a piece until it's exactly perfect in the way that you want it to be. And it's like, sometimes you're just writing about, you know, a basketball game. Sometimes you're just writing about an ostrich running down a street. Like, that's fine. Like, you know, it's like the ceiling is going to be a little bit lower. Obviously, you should try to do it as awesomely as you can, but like, you know, traffic ostrich is traffic ostrich. You know, if I take like 2 hours to write it, then I'm not doing my job right. So.
Yeah, one thing that Matt Moore has always kind of tried to ingrain with us is don't let great be the enemy of good.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, this is obviously, I like HP a lot, but like you can see, and so many of the writers from there have done stuff with the classical, or people I read elsewhere and stuff. That ability to hit that middle ground, it's not even, I mean, that almost makes it sound sort of bad, but the idea of like being able to find a way to make your argument eloquently funny, you know, like with interesting language and interesting perspective without trying to like craft the definitive last word on the thing, like that is super valuable. And also like it makes for a really readable site. That's why your site is good. And I know this with my own writing too, that there is like a bell curve for me. If I get above, you know, 12 or 1400 words, like it's diminishing returns at that point. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true for a lot of people. I think that there's very, especially if it's not like a reported piece or if it's not like some sort of sprawling other thing, like very few takes need to be longer than, you know, 800 to 1200 words.
Do you ever feel the need to push it though? Like when you know, you say, let's say you're at like 700, 800, like, nah, this needs to be longer, and you feel like you're forcing it. Does that ever happen?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I try to avoid it, and that's the thing that SB Nation has been good about there too. Is like, I think if they had their way, I would write many more 500 word pieces than I do. I mean, I think that like I've done a lot of writing, and I think that at this point I have some sense now of where I am and when it's time to stop. The issue is just going back on a lot of stuff. Like, I think my tendency is to be longer when I should be shorter, and not with the, if I'm at like 700 words, like I generally don't feel like I need to get to 1,000 for some reason or other, unless I'm writing it for another place and that's what they asked for.
Right.
But the issue mostly is that like, if I'm suddenly at 1,600 words and I'm realizing that I really should be at like 1,100 or 900, then like that's actually, usually it's easy to identify where to cut if you're that, bloated with it. But yeah, it's tough. Like, you never really totally know where you are until you're finished with it. And, there have been times where I've been writing something that I thought was, like I had a couple really good paragraphs, I made some really good points or whatever, and then you just get to the end of it and you're like, you have no idea how to end it. Or you go back at the beginning and you realize that you led with like 300 words of, just nonsense about or like the thing with the Mets piece I wrote today, just being precious in my mind, there was this long and not terribly well informed like disquisition on like how weird it is that people own sports teams and how so many of them are terrible, and here's one type of terrible owner and here's another type of terrible owner and here's what they have in common or whatever. And at some point, like, yeah, I was writing a piece about a team that has terrible owners, and the terrible owners were the focus of the piece, but like the idea of like just tacking this maundering stuff at the beginning of it. Like, you could feel me pushing back against having to write the story, like, as I was writing it. Like, I was like, oh, another thing, like, just killing clock until whenever, but yeah.
What's tougher for you, beginning a piece or ending it?
Oh, beginning it, for sure. I think when it works, I mean, when you get to a conclusion, like, there's something very exciting about that. That, because you can feel sort of this opportunity to like bring it together and make your point to write, usually that's where the heaviest sentences are. Like, that's really fun for me. But I mean, I have struggled with a lot of things. Sometimes it's the case and sometimes it's not, but that like I'll spend 45 minutes just like screwing off or, avoiding writing a thing. And then even in terms of just beginning it, I think, and that's usually where the flab is when I go back and edit. It's hard, I'm lucky, not to have a job that requires me to have a take on everything or even to write about stuff that I don't really care about. I mean, you'll never see me write about college football at SB Nation because I don't give a shit about it, and because they have a million guys that are really good at it. And I'm, very lucky to have that. I don't have to be faking it very much, but there are definitely times where like a thing happens and then I have to like think about what I think about Phil Jackson or whatever, and the fact of the matter is I don't it doesn't really matter to me very much. Like, the Knicks are fucked either way. Like, at least in this case they're paying a guy who doesn't need more money, and that's obviously always a nice thing to see happen. But like, I don't know, that's the struggle of it, is just sort of finding a thing in it that's meaningful enough for you to keep writing the thing. And if you get to the conclusion, like by that point, at least in my case, like, I'm sold on the thing. I have an idea and I have written a bunch of things about it and I want to make it awesome. Whereas at the beginning, there's definitely this voice, sometimes louder, sometimes softer, suggesting that maybe it's not worth bothering this time and you could do something else.
So I kind of want to touch more on that. It's always tough to write about something that you don't care about. Or especially like, if it's an assignment, you're like, all right, I need to get this done. Even if it's in like a sport you like, something happens in the NBA and they want us to write about that, then, while we love the sport, the subject matter is just kind of like, it's not up our alley. Like, again, something about the Knicks or something about, the Hornets or something.
Yeah, the ones I had the hardest time with that are always the takes, you know, or like a counter take or whatever, like someone said something idiotic about LeBron or whatever, and then you have to trying to find something to say other than like, please don't, you know, like that is a real, like, you know, if the actual column you want to write is like three exasperated tweets,
right,
then like that's obviously like maybe a sign you don't write it, or you leave it for somebody who's got more to say on it. But like, yeah, finish your, I don't think I let you finish your question, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, so I mean, that was my first, like, how do you fight through that, I guess?
I mean, it's tough. Like, sometimes you don't get there. I think in with a lot of this stuff, especially involving the NBA, I mean, I'm in a, I guess it's a good position for work, but it's a weird thing personally. Just, I don't really have a team that I care about now. I mean, I grew up as a New Jersey Nets fan. I really cared about them. I really do not care about the Brooklyn Nets. You know, the Knicks are, you know, I'll watch them play. I'll watch any basketball game. I'm easy like that. But they're, you know, that's an impossible team to watch and a very difficult team to pull for in a lot of ways. Just, at least last year they were. You know, so there's this kind of, like, I don't think that you can write really anything, or at least I can't write things without some element of emotional investment. That, like, I'm not an analytics guy. I'm not, like, you know, enough of a basketball scholar to be able to get into the nuts and bolts stuff and really find, you know, anything that is inspiring to me or whatever. I really respect the people that are, and I really enjoyed, I edited Mike Prada's pictures column for SB last year, and that guy really has it. Like, he really is able to diagram shit and, like, you know, he makes these GIFs and he makes, you know, videos and plays and stuff like that, and it's really interesting to me to read. I do care about basketball that way, but if I'm going to be writing about something, you know, I have to care about the people involved or care about the thing involved. And if I don't feel anything about it, like, if I don't feel anything about the Houston Rockets except for like a faint, you know, unease at having to watch Dwight Howard walk around or whatever, like, which I really don't. I mean, like, in that case, like, I'm lucky that I can defer a lot of that, but otherwise you need to sort of, I just will go further and further back until I see it fitting into something that I actually do care about, you know, which would be a way of playing or an approach to basketball or, you know, a trend one way or the other. But it's all, that's the hardest part. I mean, I think it's also difficult if you care too much. I mean, I really struggle with the Mets column just because it's, you know, I care about the team. I've cared about it my whole life. But, like, they're such a fucking bummer, and they're just really, it's really difficult to imagine things being much different or much better as long as the people that are owning the team are owning the team. But, like, that's a very depressing column. So, like, the challenge there is to write something that's not so depressing that, like, I can't finish it, and my wife comes home from work, and I'm just, like, sprawled on a couch near a bunch of empty bottles being like, Will Pons. Like, I need to be grown about it. It's just, whatever, it's, I think that's the hardest part with any of this. You know, the lucky thing is that, you know, I really do, I mean, I really like basketball. I really like baseball. Like, with football, I could feel it just watching that preseason game last night. Like, I need to, like, get it tight with football, or I need to not write about it, because, like, I was struggling to watch that shit.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bad football game. It was a preseason game, so it didn't matter or whatever. But, like, just it all was so dumb to me at that moment. I'm like, that'll change, you know. I'm gonna have three fantasy teams by the end of the weekend. I'm gonna have, you know, like, I do enjoy watching the games, you know, for whatever ethical qualms I have about it. But, like, yeah, sometimes it's harder than others.
Okay, I want to ask you about that. Is it balancing your ethical qualms with the fact that you actually enjoy the game? Does it get to you a little bit when you're watching? You're like, I don't want to watch these guys bash their heads in.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
it's kind of a fun game.
I mean, this is the thing that's, like, hardest about the NFL, and I think the thing that, there's always this challenge of you don't want to just write the same column over and over again, which is why I seldom write about amateurism. Say, I only have one thing to say about it, and I, you know, there's only, like, a dozen people alive that want to hear me say it for the second or third time, so let alone the, you know, whatever, 50th or whatever I'm on now. For the NFL, I mean, it's weird. Like, I can, I mean, I really kind of detest the league. I think the cultural, just the way that football is talked about and sold is really pretty repellent to me. But it's a great product. I mean, like, I really, the games do work for me. Like, I really do enjoy watching it. And if I don't, you know, like, again, this is another sport where I'm more or less without a team. Like, I mean, I care about the Giants a little bit, but, like, I'm never, you know, if I'm ever upset on a Tuesday about a Giants loss on a Sunday, that'll be the first time, you know. So I can watch it, and if it's working for me, I will continue watching it. And if it's not, then, like, I can always go for a walk. I mean, the harder part, I guess, with it is just, like, finding something to say that you haven't said before, finding something to say that people might want to read. And, you know, like, I do think about that. I try to think about that. But we'll see. I mean, there's also, like, you can always, and last year I was able to find stuff. I had a nice time writing these, like, silly pieces about the way that we covered Nate Burleson breaking his arm after he got in a car accident while trying to catch some pizza that was sliding out of a pizza box. Like that, and then Dwayne Bowe's mysterious pot arrest, in which he asked the arresting officer if he knew whether, like, an Arby's was still open or something like that. Think of something shittier than Arby's. Like, you may have to think hard, but it was like Jack in the Box or something. It was like a fast food franchise that no one ever wants to go to. And, like, that was the first, like, Dwayne Bowe was pulled over, like, just blazed with, like, a ton of medical weed in his car, and was just like, before you write this ticket, like, which Jack in the Box, do you know if it's open after midnight? Like, it was like a totally goofy thing. But the way that SBU let me cover it, like, obviously we needed something on it, and they had, you know, one of the people on the news desk wrote the news hit. But I got to, like, write this, like, fake conspiracy theory thing about it, about, like, you know, we still don't know, like, what really happened that night on, like, 77,000 block of, you know, Convention Center Drive in Kansas City near the Jack in the Box. But, like, you know, in that case, like, I can, my sort of happiness in making stupid jokes overwhelms the fact that, you know, like, I'm writing about something that I don't think matters. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that in some ways I'd rather, like, I mean, the idea that there are people that are, you know, in the comments of Pro Football Talk or wherever, they're like incensed at Dwayne Bowe for being so undisciplined or whatever. Like, I don't want to write something that those people would read, you know, but I also, you know, like, if I'm going to write about it, I'll try to put something fun in it and make something good out of it. That's the bit that mostly gets you over, is that an aspect of professional pride and sort of wanting to do a good job, even if you're, you know, doing something that maybe you're not the most keyed up about.
Sure. We're going to move on in a second, but I also want to ask you about when, you know, those emotional pieces that you talked about, the things that you're really emotionally invested in, you find that those are the pieces that it's easiest to write about insofar as getting words on a page, but maybe the hardest to make a point?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. I mean, the one thing that I wrote about the Brooklyn Nets last year, they got me, I was credentialed for two of the games of the series against the Raptors, and went, and, you know, like, I know that neighborhood very well. It's where I, you know, generally that's where I started out when I was living in New York, and my now wife was there for longer. I have a lot of friends who live near there. Yeah, I used to play softball near there. Like, it's a, you know, a place that I have these connections to. And so, you know, the feeling of being at, and those were actually, it was the, those were the second and third Nets games I'd been to at the Barclays Center. And at the first one, I went with a bunch of high school friends, and I was, you know, pretty drunk when I walked in the door, and I didn't really have much of an emotional experience of it. Most of the emotions were, like, trying to stay awake on the subway going home, like, wow. But in this case, like, you know, I had all these feels, but, like, I wasn't exactly sure, like, what, if anything, I had to say about, I didn't have much to say about the Nets. You know, I don't find them to be a very inspiring basketball team. I don't really, like, connect with any of my pleasure centers where basketball is concerned. And the challenge there was not writing something that was like fully a memoir of my stupid early 20s, because that's, you know, maybe I could do a good job of it, maybe not, but like that's not something that I would trust that anybody wants to read. And so that was the sort of the balance that I had to try to find, was, you know, wanting to tell the story that I felt the most deeply, which was about the New Jersey Nets and about Brooklyn and about the way that time passes and things sort of move and we move with them. And then also trying to do something that would do right by the fact that, you know, someone went to the trouble of credentialing me for two games, and that, you know, this is a basketball team I was writing about. The people that would be reading the article, or at least the first couple of hundred words of it, would be Nets fans, you know, and so I wanted to do right by that. But yeah, it's definitely one of those things where, you know, just because it helps to be in a sort of a middle ground where you have a feeling about something or you care about something in a certain way, but not so much that it's actually going to blow you off course and leave you writing, you know, some sort of song of yourself type thing.
This is actually a good segue, kind of, but not really.
I don't know. It sounds good to me. I know you haven't done it yet, but I believe in you.
Right, right. Well, so I want to talk about influences now. So I want, it's kind of two-parter. Who influenced you like at first, and then who influences you now? Like, who are you reading now that you're like, I want to write like that person? Like, who is, do you still aspire to be like someone? Do you still look up to certain writers?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the people that are writing best about sports now are significantly better than anybody that was writing about sports, or at least they're more attuned to where I want to be with it than anybody that I read growing up. I mean, I remember, I mean, this is what's weird. I think the world just sort of seemed like a smaller place in terms of what I was reading. I mean, the things that I remember reading first that really blew me away beyond, Sports Illustrated and the various different people that were in there. I vividly remember really liking, not his columns necessarily, like the back of the book things, but like Rick Riley features when I was, and this has actually been confirmed for me by other people that like Rick Riley, as with most of the people that are now like our most embarrassing veteran sports writer guys, like Rick Riley killed in like the early 90s and the 80s.
Yeah.
He was, and so I remember reading that stuff and being like, this is impressive to me and I like it. And then, you know, the guy that my dad had a subscription to the New Republic magazine in his office. He would bring it home, and the New Republic, I've written for them. I still like the magazine somewhat. You know, there's a lot of things they do I don't like. But I remember reading Michael Lewis's campaign coverage. They had him on the Republican primary in 1996. And I was, like, fiending for those every week when they would come in. And they were fantastic. I haven't read them since. And, you know, like, I don't always – I generally admire Michael Lewis a lot. I don't always, you know – dig his stuff as much, but I remember reading those and just being like, you know, all these like fringy candidates. He was really into Alan Keyes. He was really, I mean, not like into him politically, obviously he's not a crazy person, but that like, or Maury Taylor, who is this weird tire magnate from Michigan that was running a kind of a vanity campaign. And, you know, the guy that wound up, I guess, getting that nomination, was it 96? It was 96. Yeah. With like, you know, dull, as uninspiring as you could possibly be, but that like that stuff, there was something really cool about it. Like it made the process of like traveling around, hanging around people, taking notes, and then synthesizing it. I think that was the first time that I thought that writing nonfiction stuff would be really cool. And then, you know, as I read other stuff later, I remember reading the thing that David Foster Wallace wrote for Premiere about being on the set of Lost Highway, the David Lynch movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in one of the anthologies. I don't remember which now, but that like, I read that in college when I was a freshman on my giant box computer on the internet, like the pre-internet of like, like non-video pornography. You know, just, like this browser does not support frames and whatever, just like ancient prehistoric shit. But I remember reading that piece and being like, this is not like other things that I've read before at all. You know, and I was annoyed by it in some ways. I mean, I think at a time when I was in college, I think this is hilarious and so embarrassing. I think that I thought of David Foster Wallace as being like a peer almost, because he was like youngish and also wrote long sentences. And for a long time, I would read his shit and be like, that is, no, man, I would have done a much better job with that. Like, footnotes, really? Like, I use parentheses like a professional. just this asshole, drunk 20-year-old version of me, like, putting it on David Foster Wallace in my head. But I do remember reading that piece and being like, this is a thing that would be cool to be able, it would be very cool to be able to do this. And it would be very cool to be able to make something like this. You know, and then, I mean, in terms of, like, getting older and, you know, like, reading more stuff. I mean, I think eventually it all just sort of begins to accrue and you wind up writing the way that you are supposed to write. But that doesn't mean that I wouldn't like to be able to write more like Brian Phillips, for instance, or that I wouldn't want to be able to argue more the way that like Tommy Craggs does, like to have that clarity, or in Phillips's case, just the ability to really find the beautiful thing in a bigger thing. You know, those guys are giants. There's a lot of really great people that have written, you know, the classical, some of whom have graduated and some of whom have not, like, that, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm jealous of them, because, like, I'm happy with the way that I write, and, you know, the way that I write, more to the point, is the only way that I can really write well. I mean, like, I would do well to try to ape some of these guys. But, man, this is the firepower, intellectual and prose-wise, that you see from a lot of these guys, you know, that, I don't know, I admire it a lot. I mean, and also the people, I mean, Patrick Ruby was the guy that wrote at Sports Center at the same time I was there, is a dude that, like, just understands his beat so fantastically well and just knows everything about the, you know, the pieces that he's written about. Not just about concussions, he's really good with that, but also the amateurism thing especially. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, I don't have a thing that I, with all due respect to my writing about the ostrich running in traffic or whatever, like, there's nothing that I do that well. And there's a bunch of people right now doing stuff that I think really, that sentence looks stupid. There's a bunch of people who, the way that Patrick writes about that, the way that Aaron Gordon gets at sort of trends within football games and also manages to write interesting sentences about it, or the way that Colin McGowan gets angry, or the way that David Zarley, who's wrote a thing for us about skateboarding recently, writes these crazy pyrotechnic sentences. Like, any of that, like, I would love to be able to do that. I can't, so I just admire it in terms of other people being able to do it. But we're lucky that, and this is the cool thing about, I mean, obviously the uncool thing is that nobody's getting paid enough and that there's a lot of garbage out there. But the good thing about having so many places to read stuff is that, you know, you really do get to read more great writers. And I think writing wise, that helps. You can pick up some stuff that you like and hopefully not ape it too hard, but, you know, add it to the sort of stew that you're working on.
One thing I've always been talking about with like Sirit Soe and Jack Winter and a few other guys at HP is that we compete with each other, but we don't tell each other.
Yeah.
Like, so you read someone else's piece, you're like, okay, I'm going to do better than them, or like, or it's like, damn it, I wish I had written that. Do you find yourself competing, like, with your peers, like, oh, this weird kind of, I love what you wrote, but at the same time, I hate you type thing?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, it's totally natural to feel that way. And also, I mean, like, this is what's weird about it is that, you know, that when I played basketball, when I played sports as a kid or whatever, like, I was competitive. But I was not, you know, I am built like a blogger, and at the end of the day, as an athlete, I make a really excellent blogger, you know, like, but so there is this, like, frustration in not being able to win, and, you know, so I found, like, a place where I can compete a little bit better in terms of doing this, but, yeah, like, definitely. What's good about it, what you were just describing, and I think that, like, SB can work this way, I think the classical, certainly, as designed, was supposed to work that way. I mean, it wound up being something different, and I think something that works differently well. But that you know, the ability to sort of like be inspired by something without suddenly being like consumed or pissy and like subtweeting somebody or like subtweeting somebody literally or like just emotionally subtweeting them as you read their stuff.
Right.
Like that, I mean, that's totally healthy and good. And that's another reason to read more. I think, you know, I think that impulse was probably there when I was like busting on David Foster Wallace in my mind, when I was, you know, just absolutely a waste of space, which I was for, you know, the first however many decades of my life as a writer and like organism that, you know, like, but with all of that too, it was, and I would read it and I think you recognize that there's something going on there that you are either not capable of doing or that you wish you had done just so that, you know, you could have done it the way that you would want to do it. And that's like, you know, I think the idea of like a writer is somebody who is isolated and, you know, just putting their truth down on the page and sending it out there for whoever wants it, or, you know, that's, I don't even see the romance in that idea. I know that that's like, there's certainly like it's a stubborn and sort of persistent way of thinking about it, but, you know, they, at the risk of like the cheese factor on this, like if you think of it as a conversation as opposed to as an argument or as opposed to a sort of a shouting contest or, you know, whatever, just one extended first take segment at a million sided table. If you think of it as actually like a way that the things that you write are a way to communicate to people who you hope will communicate back to you a sort of a, their gloss on it or their disagreement or their whatever, like that makes for a much more interesting sort of discourse. I think that generally the basketball discourse is the one that works best. I think that everybody kind of respects everybody else and also is interested in having a good time and learning things in a way that the NFL discourse, for instance, does not generally work as well. Mm-hmm. And that's like, that's a real, I mean, not like anybody can totally claim credit for it one way or the other, but that's an achievement. Like, it's good to have the conversation about any one sport be a conversation that you'd want to participate in.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's not a lot, I mean, even in the blogosphere or like the Twitter sphere, there's not anything really like what there is for basketball specifically. I mean, like the NBA, there's, you know, you're not going to find really like, you know, like a network slash Jason's Conception, as he unfortunately had to change his name on Grantland, like on, yeah, for, you know, like football Twitter or like baseball Twitter.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's not as much like a communal feel with the other sports as there is with basketball, I guess.
Yeah, I think that, I guess a lot of that goes back to the idea that you can enjoy basketball in a nonpartisan sort of way, which, mm-hmm, you know, Scholes and them get obviously the credit that they deserve for that. Although I think that that was an idea that existed certainly before Friedarko elevated it into like a worldview or whatever. But the idea that you can like care about a team, care about the sport, and not be a total trolling dickhead about it is like, it doesn't seem very revolutionary. And yet it's like, when you read the way that the NFL is written about, for instance, or college football in a lot of ways, with, you know, obvious notable exceptions. I mean, like Spencer, who's my boss at SB, is like, I mean, just a fantastic writer. He's a really great writer. And he finds stuff in college football that I don't find there. Like, that's a guy that, you know, just write under our own roof. There's a bunch of people that write there that write things that I could never write in ways
he also
that
wrote
I could dream of writing them.
He also wrote a recap about shitting his pants twice, which was...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, he'll go there with that stuff. I think he's recapping the American Ninja Warrior TV program for us now, too. This is the advantage of being the boss. Like, if you're the guy that's like, I got 800 words coming on shitting my pants. Like, everybody's like, cool, looking forward to it. But it helps, too, that it's like, when he delivers it, it's going to be the best possible 800 words about shitting your pants. I mean, like, that anybody breathing is going to write. I can't even say I envy that, though, honestly. Like, there's not, like, a part of me that's like, oh, you know, I've definitely shat my pants more interestingly than that. Like, like, I would have found a better way to describe this sensation or whatever. Like, that, it's
like, all right, let me tell you about this time. Mine was better. Or worse.
Right. Yeah. Nice trying. here's how we do it in New York City. Yeah, right. So I don't feel that urge particularly, which is good, I guess. The urge to shit my pants or the urge to compete on that territory.
That's where you'll let him have his win.
Yeah. It's important.
So I want to take a few minutes to talk about some of your favorite pieces that you've written, also some that you wish had turned out better, or just things that, you know, you thought were going to go one way and you kind of didn't. So do you have one that really comes to mind where you're like, yeah, I was pretty damn proud of that one?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's funny, like, when you pay attention to, like, how much things get read, it's really, it changes the way that you sort of think about the stuff that you're doing. But, like, in terms of just, you know, the pieces of mine that have been shared the most and probably read the most at SB Nation, like, there's one that is, it's like three sentences and an embedded tweet and then a vine of a llama jumping across a meadow while
God, I love that one.
It's the best thing I've done. And, like, that kills me in some ways that, like, you know, I could put all this work into the, like, I wrote that whole series from Cutter, too. Like, I was really proud of that. That came out good. That's, like, 15,000 words. And, like, honestly, the llama is better than that. Like, I can't, and it's not just because, like, the, you know, the people spoke and more people, like, read it and shared it and enjoyed it. Like, the llama's fucking amazing, man. I can't compete with that. It's a DMX song and it's a llama, you know? And so it's funny, like, it's humbling in some ways. And then also, like, it sort of reminds you of how silly it is to be doing what you're doing and, like, expecting this to be like, this is it, this is the piece, and then, like, I don't know what happens then. I raptured up into heaven. Like, am I going to get a better job? I'm not, like, I don't really want another job. And so I guess the ones that I'm happiest about are the ones that I feel like I got to, at least during the SB period, are the things that I got to write that I had resources and time and that look really good because of how great the layout people and the editors are there. That, like, I think the piece I wrote about the Nets, I'm really happy about, from the end of the one I was talking about earlier about the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote, like, a column about Bartolo Colon and what matters in baseball and stuff a couple weeks ago that I liked. I have a lot of stuff there that I'm pretty happy with. I'd say that more of it, I don't know, it's, you go back like 2 years and you can sort of tell that the same person is writing something. This is true for me, but I think it's probably true for anybody. You can see that the same person is writing the piece, but you don't always, like, you can think of ways that you might want to write it better and, or that it would be different if you wrote it 2 years further on and 2 years smarter and 2 years sort of better trained. So it's hard in terms of, like, thinking about the ones that you're proudest of or whatever. And the Cutter series I'm very proud of, and it's the, you know, the hardest and the coolest thing I ever got to do.
But that series, how often was the story right in front of you, and how often did you have to kind of go and find it?
And this was what was great about, and this is, again, what I was saying about the thing that's great about being at a place and being, you know, free, not just of that, like, hunted freelance feeling of, like, you don't have time to finish this because you have to start two other things or else you're not going to be able to keep the lights on or whatever. Like, but also having that resource, they sent me there. They were like, wander around, do some stuff, talk about this, talk about that if you can, whatever. And so I was in the city by myself without really knowing anybody for five, 6 days. And I knew what I wanted to write. I had some general idea of the themes that I wanted to do, you know, to touch on or whatever. But in that case, it was just a question of wandering around and then sort of at the end of each day trying to pull my thoughts together on it. But, like, you know, as it was, I was writing while I was there. I was writing even on the flight over. The first bit about airports and duty-free stuff and everything was just, like, sort of notes while I was waiting for my Ambien to take hold. But all of that was, like, I mean, there's something nervous about it for me, about just, like, having all these notes and, you know, coming home at the end of the day and just, like, writing a few hundred words and seeing where that went. and then like later on trusting myself to pull it together and make it a thing. I mean, the story itself, and so there were a couple of days, you know, where it's like I had an appointment to talk to a guy who's an expert on this, or I was going here to do this, you know, specific thing. But a lot of it was just a question of wandering around and keeping my eyes open. And then I was lucky enough too that I had the opportunity. I wasn't just sent there to specifically write one thing. You know, I was sent there to walk around and keep my eyes open and see what happens. And then, you know, they gave me the opportunity to do it the way that I wanted to do it.
With so many aspects, not just of the story, but I mean, of the situation you're in, I mean, there's, you know, socioeconomic, there's political, there's everything. And then you're writing for a sports site. Was there ever kind of a forced feeling in your mind that you needed to keep sports somewhat at the forefront of the story, or were you?
Not really, and I give him credit for that. I don't think, I mean, it's there, but like it's also, I mean, this is the thing about it that sort of bailed me out on that, because I think I would have felt that way in some cases, like if I had been there, you know, 4 or 5 years from now where there's stadiums and stuff. Mm-hmm. Right now it's all still so nascent. I mean, there's not, the stadiums are, none of them exist yet. And when you read about the laborers dying and stuff, they're not even dying building the stadiums. They're dying building the subway. They're dying building these hotels that are eventually going to hold, you know, they're building 90,000 new hotel rooms for the fans that are notionally going to be there in 2022. And with all of that, you know, sort of, it helped in some ways because the whole place is so unfinished and so very much in progress that, like, if I wanted to write about what soccer means to Qatar, and, you know, that would be a chapter someday that I would want to write, like, I would have had to sort of find something different and find something that maybe isn't even there yet. The Qatari League has basically zero attendance. They've done their best to make it so that the expats won't care about it. And there's very few Qatari, like just numerically, there's very few. And so the games themselves, you know, they'll happen in these stadiums and there'll be like 1,500 people there, you know, like, and that's, so that sort of thing, like I would have had a very hard time, you know, finding a way to go to those games. I wanted to go to, there's a Qatari basketball league and I really wanted to go to a game there and I couldn't even find out where those games were played. But I know it's like a real league. Do you remember Jamario Davidson who played at, I think, Alabama?
Yeah,
and then
yeah,
later
Alabama.
Played for the Bobcats. So Jamario Davidson was averaging like 35 and 25 in the Qatari when I was there. Yeah, like I really, like I always enjoyed watching him play in college. Like I wanted to go watch Jamario Davidson dunk in a Qatari high school gym if I could. But like I couldn't even find anybody that knew like where the games were. Like box scores weren't in the paper. It was just, I mean, some of this, and this is like the thing that, it, you know, in a weird way, while it's one of the pieces I'm proudest of, that's also one that I wish I had, there's a lot of things that I wish I'd done differently. Like, I think that I didn't, maybe because I wasn't there that long, but also because of just this natural wish to not be uncomfortable and a sort of a basic laziness. Like, I didn't really hit the labor thing as hard as I wanted to. I mean, like, that is, I sort of wrote about your experience of, you know, seeing, or my experience of seeing this city and country being built up out of nothing by these people who are sort of faceless and anonymous and whatever. And like, I suppose that's true to life, but also like, it didn't really advance the understanding of what they're doing and what's being done to them or whatever. And obviously maybe that's better left to people from The Guardian and better left to Human Rights Watch and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it still kind of felt like when I came back, I got a million things about this fucking mall and how weird duty-free stores are. And it's like, I didn't talk to a laborer. I didn't, you know, see how they live or whatever. And so I was relying on the secondhand stuff. And the same thing with like, you know, actually hunting down, like trying to find a game to watch. I did wind up seeing a portion of a soccer game there, but it was like this weird friendly between two teams from India being played at some like weird community stadium for an audience entirely of South Asian men. And I saw like 5 minutes of it. It was by accident. Like I had no idea that it was happening. I followed the sound of like air horns and yelling people. And I got there in time for the end of penalty kicks. I was lucky that I did, you know, but there was definitely, I remember that as being like, I was sort of proud of it when I went home. I was like, you didn't just go home and like swim in the pool on the roof of your hotel. Like you went and found this game. And then part of, you know, the counter argument for that which arrived instantly, is like, yeah, fucking course you did. Like, you're here working. Like, you're not here to swim in the pool on the roof of your hotel. Like, you don't pat yourself on the back too hard because you, like, did 5 minutes of
your job.
Like, yeah, right, right. Instead of, like, going upstairs and having some snacks. Like, which is obviously, you know, it's my impulse to, I love snacks. Like,
sure,
I love going
who doesn't?
Years. Yeah, but it's, whatever. So it's hard. I mean, I think the things that I feel most sort of like disappointed in myself about or disappointed to have written in a lot of ways. In some cases, it's mostly because I mostly care about the language that I'm using. Like, I want to write really beautiful pieces more than I want to write, you know, the definitive argument about this or that. Because, like, I'm not as good at arguing about sports as I am at writing sentences in a lot of ways. Like, I think I'm okay at arguing about sports, but I'm definitely better at the other thing. Mm-hmm. The ones that I'm, like, sort of frustrated by are ones where, like, I didn't really have an argument, and maybe the sentences weren't totally on point either. I don't think that, you know, I try really hard. I mean, they're not, I don't think I ever write anything that like totally super sucks, but there's a lot of stuff where I'll go back and look at it and just be like, you didn't really need to write this. Or I remember I wrote something about Marshall Henderson's suspension by Ole Miss last year for, it was before the season, I think it was like for drugs and stuff, and they wanted to kick him out of school. And I mean, obviously Marshall Henderson's an idiot, and they don't really need me taking his side. But also at the same time, like there's what I wound up writing that about was this sort of like, it was a case of writing the same thing for the 1,000,000th time, you know, that it was just
right.
This kind of like scolding thing about how much more college athletics owes the athletes than it actually ever gives them. And like, you know, it's not to say that I wasn't faking it, you know, like I really did believe that. And I think, you know, I certainly made my argument with a great deal of vigor. But it's also, but like at the end of the day, like I didn't have an argument to make. And so I was filibustering for 1600 or 1700 words or some too long amount. And like, no wonder very few people read it, you know, or no wonder, I mean, it's like, it's not a thing that anybody really needed to read. It was just me making noise. And when I feel bad about stuff, that's what I feel like, you know, or that's the way that I feel badly about it, that there's this sense that I just sort of not just like wasted everybody's time, but also just like sucked all the oxygen out of a room so that I could use a bunch of adjectives to make a point that was already obvious to everybody involved. Like, that's not, I don't know. That's probably overly harsh, but it's also,
that's a really upbeat way of looking at that story.
That is actually the thing that's like the biggest, I think, challenge with this, you know, with writing about things I actually care about, or with, you know, like I was saying about the Mets or whatever. It's like, I'm kind of prone to depression. I am also like tend to, you know, like there's a lot of times where like, if the only thing I have to say about something is like, it sucks, like then I need to back the fuck off of that and let someone else write it. Cause like, even though I can probably say it sucks in a way that's like pleasing to me, like why would I ask anybody to spend, you know, even 5 minutes of their time, like reading, like me telling them how much a thing sucks. Like, this is, I mean, that's like actually like fundamental to the way that Spencer has set up SB and the way that I think that feature understands itself. But also, which is similar in ways to the way that SB understands itself. The Spencer term for it is that SB is an appreciation machine, that the idea is we are there to help enhance everyone's enjoyment of a thing. And that's not necessarily always by like cheerleading and, you know, OMGing something or whatever, but it's, you know, like everything should serve to help you have a better and deeper and more beneficial understanding of this thing that you already care about,
mm-hmm.
which is good. But like, if I can't contribute to that, if the only thing that I can contribute to this thing that you care about is pointing out to you that it's fucking awful and you shouldn't care about it at the way that you do, then like, I'm insulting you at that point. I shouldn't be writing it.
So, but then again, like sometimes celebrating and like the misery is also kind of a way of like appreciating that team, or that like, this is how historically fucking bad this team is. Like, let's delve deeper into this.
Oh,
like
for sure. For sure. And I think too, that even some of it is like in terms of like caring about, But this is like the split that I think, like, I keep coming back to in terms of things that I say over and over again. But, like, I think that sports are great and leagues generally are not. And that, like, and the sort of the way that the structures of power in college sports especially, but then also in pro sports in a lot of ways, that, like, you can find a way to be angry about a thing and still be sort of writing from fundamentally from a place of love and appreciation. And even if that's like writing about how horrendously shitty a team is, like if you're writing that because you're like angry at that team for being so shitty, then like you might get a couple of good jokes off, but like at some point you're again wasting everybody's time. But if it's like as somebody who likes basketball very much, the 2011-2012 Bobcats make me want to blast myself into space or whatever. Like, and that's like, then maybe there's something to say because you can approach it from, you know, like you can have a sort of aesthetic and emotional approach to it while also not blowing sunshine up everybody's ass about, like, you know, 2 years from now, I think we'll all be surprised where Bismack Biyombo is or whatever, you know, like, no, you can appreciate things even as they suck.
Right.
As long as you want to, as long as you actually appreciate them.
Well, I feel like that's a really good note to end on. You can appreciate things even if they suck.
Yeah, I also, and with Bismack Biyombo, I've been working towards that. I mentioned it was 2 hours and 45 minutes ago. I did mention that conclusions are kind of my thing. Glad I got him in there.
Well, can you compare him to some sort of meat? I feel like that's the only way to do it.
Oh, God, that's really sad. what is, like, you know what's embarrassing, actually, is I think I've seen, like, maybe 5 minutes of Biyombo even playing. So I'm basically imagining that he's, like, a younger, maybe more fit version of Johan Petro. Just, like, a tall guy who looks like he's wearing roller skates all the time out there. It falls down a lot.
I mean, yeah, like, you're kind of close with that. Yeah.
I kind of, like, actually feel like I should see him. I actually have a deep appreciation for, like, a certain type of super athletic basketball dude that has no idea how to play basketball. Like, there's something really, like, poignant about, like, Anthony Randolph. Or,
oh, my God, of course, yeah.
Because he's just, like, he's totally built for it, but he's also always playing out there like he's just, like, this tall guy that was walking by and some dude pushed him in there. Like, go! Dunk! They don't know. I saw him wreck a dude's computer when I was covering a Nets game, a Nets Wolves game. Lost the ball out of bounds for no reason and just dead-eyed like somebody's laptop. It was like it didn't explode, but it might as well have exploded. He just looked so sad. Anyway, that's a better note to end on. Let's do that. Let's end on a sad Anthony Randolph.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot, David. I really appreciate it.
No, dude, thank you for having me. I hope that you can edit something cool out of this because I talked a lot.
This is going on raw. There's no editor.
Raw as hell. Good stuff. I wish I'd cursed more. But yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Have a good one. Bye.